This is an interview with Mr. Cam Pazell, conducted by Max Luna on June 26, 1973, regarding his personal experiences and accounts prior to 1930.
I have been honored by the Texas A&I University by being asked through one of the students, Max Luna, to relate some experiences of the Bee County area prior to 1930 to be taped and become a part of the South Texas Oral History and Folklore Collection of the A&I Library. Before doing so, however, I feel that a resume of my early background should be given to acquaint those who hear this recording with the period during which I have lived. I am Camp Ezell of Beeville. In January 1972, I retired as editor of the Beeville Bee-Picayune after having served in that capacity 27 years. I was born in Beeville on July 23, 1894, the youngest of eight children of Robert A. Ezell and Sarah Jane Camp Ezell. The other children were Will, John, Robert Jr., Sam, Felix, Alan, and Sally. All of the children, except myself, were born in Refugio. In 1892, my father purchased the Cottingham residence in St. Mary's, raised it and hauled the lumber in wagons over sandy and muddy roads to Beeville, and built a farm-type house near the east bank of Poesta Creek on two blocks of land purchased from Vigo Kaler. My grandfather, Sam D. Ezell, built three chimneys while my father was erecting the residence. There was a fireplace in the parlor, one in the dining room, and one in the front bedroom. The big wood cooking stove in the kitchen was connected with the dining room chimney. The three fireplaces and the kitchen stove provided the heat to keep us warm during winter months. The big oven in the range was used to cook biscuits, light rolls, light bread, cakes, pies, puddings, roasts, and sweet potatoes. Mama also used the fireplace in the dining room to cook hoe cakes, biscuits, Irish stew, and pot roasts on coals of fire that were pulled near the hearth. Grandpa Ezell and Grandma Camp lived with us. So with Mama and Papa and eight children, a total of 12, it was necessary for us to have a productive garden and to raise our own chickens, hogs, cows, and calves to provide food for the table. It was the duty of the older boys, and as I grew older, I assumed my part of the work, to chop wood for the fireplaces and cook stove, milk the cows, slop the hogs, and work in the garden. The older boys kept the family well supplied with wood for the fireplaces. They hitched a pair of horses to a wagon and went to Mr. Kaler's F9 pasture 6 miles west of our home, where they loaded the wagon with wood and with Mr. Kaler's permission. There was no sewer system in Beeville during the early 1900s, and consequently, every home had a small outhouse, which was kept clean by the town scavenger. Ours was located about 150 feet south of the residence. We called it the Little House. Since this comfort station was so far away from the home, each bedroom had a chamber for the convenience of the sleepers. When I became about 7 years of age, it was my duty to take the chambers out each morning, wash them and place them in the sunlight, and bring them back about dark. Mr. C.P. Edson built an opera house in 1887 and brought many stage plays to Beeville. When I was about 5 years of age, Grandpa Ezell would take me to see the plays. Having had this early introduction to footlight entertainments, I developed a love for the stage plays, and despite the many advantages of movie productions, I still prefer entertainment on the stage in person. One of the early dramas that came to Beeville year after year was East Lynne. My brothers formed a string orchestra and played for many dances and entertainments at the Opera House. and they told me about several unusual incidents that occurred there. One night when East Lynn was being staged, the villain threatened the heroine with ruination because she refused to marry him. Will Parker, a young man with a strong body and a sympathetic heart, stepped to the stage and declared, "You're not going to harm that girl as long as I'm in the audience." At the end of the act, the mean man made a curtain call and expressed his appreciation for Will's reaction. He said it made him feel that he had given a realistic performance. In 1908, a new opera house was built at the corner of Washington and Bowie Streets by A.F. Reese and E.J. Kinkler. It was a three-story structure with balcony, dress circle, and boxes. A stock company was organized, and Murray Edson, son of C.P. Edson, who had learned how to book good plays for his father's theater, was made manager. In 1911, I became one of Murray's ushers, and this enabled me to see some of the best stage production that toured the South after having had a season on Broadway in New York. Among the plays that came to Beeville were 45 Minutes from Broadway, Prince of Tonight, Rosemaid, Spring Maid, The Havoc, which was a great drama with only three characters, Paid in Full, Within the Law, The Klansman, with nine horses on the stage at one time, Thomas Dixon in the leading role of his play, Sins of the Father, A Man's Game, Taming of the Shrew, The Lion and the Mouse, The Wolf, The Count of Monte Cristo, The Right of Way, The Beggar Prince Opera Company playing The Beggar Prince, Olivet, and The Mikado, and many others. With the foregoing list of musicals, comedies, and dramas, it can be seen that Beeville became an entertainment center for Bee and contiguous counties from as far back as 1887 until the Grand Opera House was destroyed by fire during Christmas week of 1919. That conflagration brings to mind another story. With the coming of movies, stage plays ceased making tours of the South, and the Grand Opera House as an entertainment center began to fade out of the picture. There were several office suites in the front of the second and third stories. On the third floor was a vacant room which was leased to some local gamblers, where they held frequent sessions. Entrance was by invitation only. One night during the Yuletide of 1919, a group of gamblers met on the top floor of Beeville's skyscraper for indulgence in games of chance. There was some sizable folding money around the table, and betting, starting moderately to get the feel of conditions, soon became spirited, and the stakes increased as time ensued. Finally, around the midnight hour, one of the men who had been losing decided to shoot the works in an effort to replenish his pile of dough. He wagered every cent he had on hand, on the hand that had been dealt him. It was a good hand, but not good enough. He lost. The night was blustery, a blue norther having made its advent into the town early that day. A pot-bellied stove was red hot. It had been periodically stoked with wood to keep the wagerers comfortable. The man who lost his last dollar left the gambling table, went to the stove, and in a moment of mad temper, kicked the stove over. The door flew open and the hot coals rolled out onto the floor. Almost immediately the room was ablaze, and the gamblers gathered their money and left the burning building. The Grand Opera House that once had been Beeville's pride and joy soon was reduced to ashes and heaps of twisted iron frames and shattered bricks and concrete. That was the story that went the rounds the following morning. Until 1907, all business houses on the west side of the 100 block of North Washington Street and the south side of Bowie Street of the same block were of fine construction. All sidewalks were made of lumber, and each store had a different level of walkways. On the night of January 31st, 1907, all frame structures on this block were destroyed by fire, with the exception of the Lendl Hotel, a three-story building at the corner of Corpus Christi and Washington. These were replaced with brick buildings. Exactly 1 year later, January 31st, 1908, the east side of Washington Street went up in smoke, and a few months later, the Lendl Hotel was destroyed. Those 2 years brought about a transition from the pioneer days to the beginning of putting into execution plans for the modern little city that is now Beeville. Until 1905, there were no fire plugs in Beeville, and until that time, fighting fires was done by people who answered the alarm. They used garden hose attached to a hydrant, piped to a cistern that was furnished water by a windmill, and the bucket brigade also was active in the attempts to extinguish the conflagrations. The fire alarm consisted of blowing whistles and firing guns and shouting. In 1905, the fire department was organized. The charter members were Louis Biette, chief, George Farr, George Atkins, Charlie Wright, Charlie Sheldon, Frank McKinney, Stanfield Thompson, Dave Stockbridge, and Ellis Quinn. All of these men have passed to the great beyond. In 1905, a fire plug was installed at the corner of Washington and Bowie Streets. The Beeville Cotton Oil Mill, then located about where the Whataburger restaurant now stands, had the only large hose in the town. When a fire developed in the proximity of the plug, Jim Hermes, operator of a dray drawn by a pair of mules, would drive to the oil mill, get the hose, and bring it to the fire. Many people attended the conflagrations and brought their buckets to help pour water on the flames. Beeville was incorporated on June 1, 1908, with John R. Beasley as mayor under the aldermanic form of government. Shortly after that date, the city council purchased a chemical hand-drawn hook-and-ladder truck and a two-wheel hose apparatus that would hold 300 feet of hose. That equipment was housed in a small corrugated iron building north of where Hotel Kaler now stands. As the years rolled by, the city added to the equipment, and during recent years, the Commissioner's Court has helped by purchasing fire trucks, since the firemen service the entire county. Beeville is now has one of the strongest volunteer fire departments in Texas. During the winter months of the early 1900s, we had hog-killing days. We would wait for a cold spell so that the meat would be chilled immediately after being dressed. Since there were no weather reports, we had no knowledge of when a cold blue norther would arrive. The only advance notice would be a dark blue cloud in the north. Since the hog had been fattened on good, clean corn from the field, the animal was ready to make the supreme sacrifice at any time the weather was favorable. When the cloud bank formed in the north, one of the boys would clean the big wash pot, fill it with water, and build a fire around it. By the time the cold spell struck, the water was warming up. Papa would get the old rifle and shoot the hog between the eyes, then stick a butcher knife into the animal's heart to bleed him. As soon as the blood had left the animal, the water was hot, and three of the boys would cover the carcass with gunny sacks, pour hot water over the sacks until the bristles would pull freely, then start scraping with knives. Within a little while, the animal, attached to a single tree, was free from hair and ready to be pulled with block and tackle high enough for Papa to dress the pig. Very little of the animal was thrown away or buried. The casings were cleaned to be used as containers for sausage. The feet were pickled. The fat was cut out and placed in a pot over fire to render it, saving the grease for lard. The cracklings were kept for making crackling bread, mixed into cornmeal and baked the same way that cornbread is cooked. Hogshead cheese was made out of the head, and this was a delectable dish during the olden days. After the fat had been cut away from the sausage meat, the sausage grinder was cleaned and the grinding ensued. Mama packed some of the sausage by making little patties, placing them in a crock of melted grease, and set them aside to cool. When the grease congealed, the crock was placed in a cool pantry for future use. This procedure preserved the meat for an indefinite period. The smokehouse adjoined the windmill, and when the meat was cut up and cooled, the pieces were hung in the smokehouse, and a smoke fire was started for the curative process. Papa always also cured some of the meat by placing it in crocks of brine. We made our own laundry soap in a big wash pot out in the backyard. It was called lye soap. There was no water system in Beeville until after the turn of the century, and practically every home had a windmill to provide water. Beeville was called the Windmill City. During my early boyhood, the creeks were running streams most of the time. Springs in the various water holes kept a light trickle going, and many times I and other boys bent over a sand or gravel bed in Poesta Creek and drank the clear water as it flowed gently over the sand and pebbles. In later years, the springs played out and the streams became polluted. E.C. Whitten, retired president of State Bank and Trust Company of Beeville, says the springs dried up because the people killed all the alligators, and the alligators had been keeping the springs open. There were three swimming holes, two around Beeville and one near Skidmore, that provided recreation and much pleasure for the boys during the early part of the current century. The lime kiln was located where Farm Road 673 bridge crosses Poesta Creek. It was named lime kiln because tradition relates that early settlers used the hole as a furnace in which they burned limestone or shells and reduced them to lime. It was about 6 feet deep, and that is where I learned to swim. In recent years, the hole has been filled with mud and rubbish. Round Rock was a 12-foot hole of water with a rock embankment for a diving platform located about 2 miles up Poesta Creek from the lime kiln. This was delightful swimming. One of the floods filled the hole with sand, and it no longer exists. Corrigan Pool, which was so deep that no diver ever was able to touch the bottom, is located on Rance's Creek about 4 miles east of Skidmore. This was the best swimming hole in Bee County. During recent years, it has become polluted and is no longer used as a swimming hole. Some excellent swimmers were developed in those three pools. If any lad showed up in a bathing suit, he was considered a sissy. During the late 1890s and early 1900s, children never called a grown person, by his first name. They addressed their seniors with Mr., Mrs., or Miss, and even relatives had a prefix. It was Cousin Frank, Cousin Matilda, Uncle John, or Aunt Martha. Of course, there is no harm done when a youth of 15 years says, "Hi there, Jim," to a man between the ages of 50 and 80 years, but because of the meticulous training our parents of the olden days gave us, it is a sort of shock to us to hear a youngster take such liberties. The songs of the pioneer days were mostly on the sad side. There was, for instance, that letter edged in black, which was so popular around the turn of the century. He never knew the sorrow that he, the postman, brought me till he handed me that letter edged in black were part of the lyrics of that tear-jerking melody. The letter announced the death of a loved one. In those days, it was customary for people who had had a death in a family to use stationery that had a black border around both the envelopes and the writing paper. Other songs I heard as a child included "Her Bright Smiles Haunt Me Still," "He Told Me So Out in the Moonlight," "Silver Threads Among the Gold," "After the Ball Is Over," "Old Black Joe," and others. And during my teenage, popular songs included "In the Evening by the Moonlight," "Melancholy Baby," "On Moonlight Bay," "Wait Till the Sun Shines Nellie," "Carry Me Back to Old Virginny," "Down by the Old Mill Stream," "Oh You Beautiful Doll," and others. Many barbershop quartets were organized at school, and it was popular to go serenading, usually visiting the homes of beautiful girls and singing in the moonlight at the gate. Also, young men would employ a string orchestra to serenade their sweethearts, and sometimes the musicians would go on their own nocturnal visits to favor young ladies after having played for a dance. When I was 17, I learned to play the flute, and I and three other young men organized a dance orchestra and played for entertainments in South Texas towns. That was while I was an apprentice in the local newspaper office. In later years, in the 1930s, while I was working on the Corpus Christi Caller, a group of Mexican musicians serenaded me about 1 o'clock in the morning. The man who brought them, Steve Rodriguez, worked with me on the Caller. After the musicians played one selection at the window outside, I asked them to come in. My wife was out of town at the time. Steve asked me to get my flute and play with them. I could see that they were not too happy over this suggestion because they knew that the average gringo knew nothing about their kind of music. Well, I got the flute tuned up with their instruments, and the leader asked, "What would you like to play?" I said, "Do you play Amor con Amor Si Paga?" They replied in the affirmative. So we began, and when we finished, they were amazed that I could play their music. They asked me to go serenading, and I agreed on conditions that they would not visit low dives or saloons. We played about 4 selections at the first residence, and then they invited us inside and served wine. Being a teetotaler, I drank water to their amazement because liquor is one of the weaknesses of musicians. After we played a beautiful Mexican waltz at the second home, a man came out and thanked us graciously, but explained that the family was in luto riguroso, which means deep mourning. And the musicians understood that people who had lost a loved one by death were not supposed to have musical entertainment for a period of 30 days. So we moved on to the next, and the next, and the next, at each of which places liquor was served, and my compadres never turned down a drink. Mrs. Carolyn Page and her husband, D.S. Page, settled on Aransas Creek, 3 miles north of the present town of Skidmore, in 1885. Mrs. Page was a midwife and delivered babies whenever called upon throughout the settlement. She also prescribed medicine for sick people since there were no licensed medical doctors available. She made the visits to her patients in her buggy and was called Dr. Page. Eliza Jane Cook Moses, wife of Joshua Moses, a native of England who settled in the little village of Mondiola in Northby County around 1880, had some kind of certificate that permitted her to deliver babies and to take care of the minor ills of people. She was called Dr. Liza Jane, and she, too, made the rounds in her buggy. And an apocryphal story relates that the village derived its appellation from a suggestion offered by a traveling salesman. When he asked the name of the community, he was told that it had never been named. He requested that it be called Mondiola. The knight of the Grips' name was Monty and his wife Ola, so the settlement was named in honor of the couple who called at the general store to sell merchandise. During the 1890s and early 1900s, physicians were scarce, and many people had to rely on old-fashioned remedies that had been handed down from pioneers. Some of these homemade medications were for a seven-year itch, mix sulfur in hog lard and grease the body from head to foot every day for 3 days, then give the lad a bath and wash and boil everything except the boy. For chest colds, apply mutton suet over the throat and lungs. Take the white of an egg, beat it, and eat it for nausea. A good cough syrup was made by slicing an onion and sprinkling sugar over the slices, then drink the juice. Remedy for blood poison and carbuncles. Apply a mixture of yolks of eggs and salt to the infected place. And to cure boils, make a poultice of Madeira leaves to draw out the corruption. For hiccups, place a pencil behind the right ear within 2 minutes, the spasmodic inspiratory movement consisting of a sudden contraction of the diaphragm accompanied with closure of the glottis, the inrush of air against the glottis producing a peculiar sound, will disappear. When I was a lad about 6 years old, a neighbor's dog bit me on the hand while I was trying to pet him. My grandfather immediately gave me the substitute for a tetanus shot. He took some hog lard and mixed gunpowder into it and made me swallow the medication. The late Mr. Jim Ballard, retired druggist, former mayor of Beeville, and ex-postmaster, was called Beeville's champion yarn teller. One of his favorite stories was, in substance, as follows. Mr. Ballard and several other men were loafing in a barber shop in Beeville around 1903 when a stranger came in and asked for a shave. About the same time, another stranger entered, took his seat in the second barber's chair, and requested a shave and haircut. Stranger number one began telling his barber about a catfish he had caught the night before in Nueces River. It weighed 150 pounds, he said. Stranger number two interrupted to say, I went fishing on that river several days ago. I felt a pull on my line, and after considerable jerking, I brought in an old rusty lantern, and it was still burning. Stranger number one sat erect in his chair and replied, Now you know darn well that lantern that had been buried in the muddy bed of a river couldn't be burning when you brought it out to the surface. Stranger number two was quick with an answer. Tell you what I'll do, friend. If you'll take 100 pounds off that catfish, I'll blow out the lantern. During my childhood, it was a popular custom to tell riddles at parties and family gatherings. I remember one riddle that no one could guess the correct answer. It ran like this. 12 pears were hanging high. 12 men came riding by. Each man took a pear and left 11 hanging there. The answer was, the person who took the pear was named Each Man. Games played by children 70 years ago included marbles, spinning tops, hide-and-go-seek, drop-the-handkerchief, musical chairs, King King Conoco, Darebase, cats and dogs, flinch, dominoes, checkers, tiddledywinks, winkum squinkum, and others. When the Irish colonists claimed their land grants issued by the Mexican government in the 1830s in the area that is now Bee County, they found knee-high grass in much of the territory and realized that this could be developed into a stockman's paradise. They started with longhorn cattle, but soon introduced the Durhams and Herefords. The Durhams later were called shorthorns. And as the years rolled by, other breeds such as the Angus, Charolais, and Brahman for beef and show animals, and Jerseys and Holsteins for milk were imported. Bee County became one of the outstanding livestock centers of South Texas. Early farmers planted most of their land to cotton, but later learned to diversify and plant grain crops, flax, and broom corn in addition to cotton. The colonists worked their fields with handmade plows pulled by oxen. Beeville's first newspaper was the Beeville Bee, established in 1886 by William O. McCurdy, just in time to chronicle the arrival of the first train of the San Antonio and Aransas Pass Railroad into the city. 4 years later, the Southern Pacific extended the line from Victoria to Beeville, and this brought another newspaper, the Beeville Picayune, established by two McFarland brothers, formerly of New Orleans. George H. Atkins purchased this newspaper in 1907, and in 1928, he and his associates purchased the Bee and consolidated the two periodicals under the name of the Bee Picayune. I started my newspaper career as a printer's devil, which is newspaper parlance for a composing room apprentice, in January 1911 at a salary of $5 a month. That was considered a starting wage for a youth who planned to become a newspaper man. Following the death of Mr. Atkins in 1959, his son-in-law and daughter, Fred and Joyce Latcham, and Mrs. Atkins became owners of the publishing company. Mr. Latcham is the current publisher. The First National Bank was organized on December 30, 1889, with L.B. Randall as president, A.C. Jones vice president, and B.W. Klipstein cashier. Before the bank came into existence, people left their money in sacks under a counter at Captain A.C. Jones' general merchandise store. The Commercial National Bank was formed January 13, 1893, with Dr. Luther B. Creeth as president, A.G. Kennedy vice president, and D.C. Stone cashier. In 1906, the Beeville Bank and Trust Company opened for business with J.C. Daugherty as president, J.C. Burroughs, vice president, and M.W. Bates, cashier. This bank changed its name to State Bank and Trust Company in 1931 when J.C. Burroughs was named president. There were two legal hangings in Bee County. On December 22, 1871, a Mexican named Bartola Guerra was hanged for the murder of Alexander H. Reed, a ranchman residing in Goliad County. The second was that of James Edward Singleton on April 27, 1877, for the murder of John C. Dwyer in July 1875. Both of these executions occurred before my time, but since I recently completed writing the historical story of Bee County, Texas, to be published in August 1973 by the Beeville Publishing Company, I have reviewed many documented evidences, especially of the Singleton will, and have some information that writers have sought for years to obtain, but in vain. Singleton was about 22 years of age and from all accounts came from a highly respected Christian family. It was said that he, quoted, was a victim of circumstance, having fallen into bad company, quoted. Mr. Sid Smith, who is 99 years of age and has a clear memory of past events, told me that if Singleton had given himself up to the officers, he would have been exonerated, but he fled and later was apprehended by Sheriff D.A.T. Walton. The unusual interest taken by writers in the Singleton hanging was prompted by a will he wrote while in the Galveston jail for safekeeping pending his execution. Sheriff Walton offered a liberal sum of money to anyone who would cut the lethal rope, but no one would claim the offer. Also, there was no one present who understood how to properly tie a hangman's noose, except the man who, around whose neck the fatal loop was to be placed. So Singleton tied the halter for his own extinction. His final words were, "Goodbye, Mr. Walton. I'm indebted to Miss Jean DeGaulle, journalism and English teacher in A.C. Jones High School, for a copy of Singleton's will. Several words of the document were worm-eaten, and this will be indicated as I read it to you." The will follows. Quoted. "In the name of the omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient of science and common sense, amen. I, J.E. Singleton, cosmopolite, now sojourning in Galveston Jail, State of Texas, and being of sound mind, do by these presents will, devise, and bequeath for the diffusion of anatomical knowledge among mankind, my mortal remains to J.J. Swan on the following conditions. First, that my body, after the execution, be prepared in the most scientific and skillful manner known in anatomical art, and placed in his office in the courthouse in Beeville, Outer Temple of Justice. Second, it is my express desire that if Dave Walton has no objections, that two drum heads be made of skin, on one of which shall be written in indelible characters Pope's universal prayer, and on the other the following verdict: We, the jury, find the defendant, James E. Singleton, guilty of murder in the first degree as charged in the indictment, and assess the death penalty. The said drumheads to be presented to my distinguished friend and fellow citizen, Frank Bogus, drummer for Tom Holly's division, on the following conditions: that he, the aforesaid Frank Bogus, shall beat or cause to be beaten on said drumheads the popular tune," and these words are not legible, "on the 8th day of June, annually. The viscera and other parts of my body, useless for anatomical purposes, I wish composted for a fertilizer and presented to Mr. Barclay, proprietor of the Grand Palace Hotel in Beeville, to be used by him for the purpose of nourishing the growth of cabbage, turnips, potatoes, and other garden sass, that the worthy people of Bee County, or at least the masculine portion thereof, may have something to relieve the monotony of hash and dried apples during their brief sojourn at the aforesaid hotel while assembled in Beeville for the purpose of dishing out justice to the violators of the law. Signed, J.E. Singleton. The foregoing is my last will and testament, and I wish J.J. Swan to act as executor. I feel grateful to the citizens of Bee County in general and to J.J. Swan in particular for the many favors conferred upon me by them. I also feel that I am indebted to them to some extent pecuniarily, and being at present in indigent circumstances, I write and leave this will alike to liquidate my debts and prove my gratitude. Singleton's body was interred in the old Evergreen Cemetery, but a number of people registered complaints, saying they did not want a convicted murderer buried near their loved ones. So the body was exhumed and laid to rest in the Potter's Field of the burial ground. My allotted time is just about exhausted, and I hope that I have given you some experiences that will show some of the customs, habits, and way of life of the people during the pioneer days. It is a privilege to do this for our high-standing Texas A&I University at Kingsville. At 5 a.m., the mariachis were well loaded, and it seemed that the drunker they became, the sweeter they played. Yet there was one problem. They became engaged in arguments, all in Spanish, very little of which I understood. But I saw that they were bordering on an altercation, so I asked Steve to take me home, which he did. It was a delightful experience, and I learned a lot on that serenade. But I realized that it was a one-night engagement and did not call for a repeat performance. I started the school in the fall of 1902. Ms. John W. Flannoy, Miss Gussie to the students, was my teacher. Every morning at 8 o'clock, the pupils lined up on a foot-wide boardwalk in front of the schoolhouse and marched into the building while Miss Estelle de Gaulle played a spirited march. If anyone got out of line, he was reprimanded. Miss Gussie stood at the entrance beating time to the music with a small stick, while upstairs Miss Mattie Musset kept time to the music by hitting the floor with a long pole about 2 inches in diameter. The sound could be heard throughout the building. Going to our rooms, we were seated, and the day's work started. Each teacher taught all of the subjects that were included in the curriculum of his or her grade. For instance, in the fifth grade, Mrs. Ida Nations taught arithmetic, spelling, reading, geography, grammar, and mental arithmetic. At the end of a semester, if a student failed to make a passing grade in one subject, he had to remain in that class for another 4 months. There were many common school districts in Bee County, and each school had one or two teachers, depending upon the number of students. But in the case there was one teacher, he taught classes in all required subjects for 6 grades. Some of these students came to the Beeville School to continue their studies, and many of them were outstanding in their work. Bee County has had 3 major floods during my lifetime. In 1903, 1960, which was prompted by the Hurricane Carla, and 1967, the Beulah flood. Although more rain fell during the Beulah flood, a total of 31 inches, it was spread out over a period of 5 days. The heaviest damage was done by the 1903 cloudburst, which poured down 12 inches of water in 4 hours. Every bridge in Bee County went downstream, and Poesta Creek rose 1 foot higher than during the Beulah deluge. The lives of 2 Mexicans were lost in the 1903 disaster. Bee County has had many physicians to care for the sick during the since the county was organized in 1858, but 2 of the most colorful and useful doctors did not even have a license to practice medicine, and both were women.